You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Vohner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us this Sunday evening. You know, there's been so much talk over the last few decades, in fact, perhaps even longer than that, maybe as far back as when I was going to school, which is probably in the dark ages. But the fact of the matter is that education, everybody has an opinion about education. How do we measure education? How necessary is education? Can we make it better? Is it reaching all students across this nation? So much has been talked about, so much has been written about. And that's why my guest this week, Josh Beach, educator and author, is joining me. In fact, his two recent books, Can We Measure What Matters Most? And The Myths of Measurement and Mediocrity. Meritocracy. As you can see, my education wasn't all that great. So we'll be talking with Josh for the next half hour and getting some insights as to, you know, what is important. At the end of the day, I think most people would want their child or their student to come away with a positive experience. That's not always the case. Josh, nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Al. Glad to be here.
I've had the opportunity recently. I've got a child that's just about ready for college, so we've been visiting campuses. And I got to tell you, some of the, you know, at least up here in New England, and a lot of people always say, oh, geez, Massachusetts, you guys have the elite schools. Well, you know, I don't necessarily... I'm not arguing with that. I'm just saying that there's good schools all over the country. But the fact of the matter is, you know, we found kids who were thought that the college experience, and these were sometimes sophomores and even juniors, so they'd had some time there. It was a positive experience. Others were not as happy as they thought they might be. Some thought the curriculum was, you know, much too difficult. Others thought it was a piece of cake. In other words, what I'm getting at is there was no consensus, but you can't blame the students, right? This goes back to what? Administrators, people who write the laws. I mean, who should really have a hand in determining what's the best strategy for education and how do we measure that?
Well, it's a very interesting question and complex, and there's actually a couple assumptions embedded in what you were just talking about there. Number one is students. What do students want? Assuming that all students want the same thing, which they don't. You know, some go to college for a social atmosphere. You know, they want to join a fraternity or hang out with their friends, drink beer on the weekend, go to football games, meet girls, meet a future, you know, wife or husband. Some go for academics. Some have no idea what they want to do with their life. And they're going to college because everyone else is going to college and they feel they have to go to college. And then, you know, teachers, administrators, they have to somehow accommodate and please these diverse student bodies as well as taxpayers and, you know, various political parties, you know, parents, academics. You know, there's just so many different groups of people with so many different interests. And so at root here in terms of thinking about school quality is thinking about schools as kind of political institutions that are trying to satisfy a number of different needs. And, you know, on the surface, there's a certain impossibility there. You know, it's the same thing with government. How can you make everyone happy? You can't. So part of the problem of thinking about school quality is trying to unpack all of the various interests. Who wants what? Why? Who's getting what? How are they getting it? You know, where are the resources coming from? So in terms of the overall quality of the academic curriculum, certainly that's, you know, in the hands partly of the educators, the teachers, or in terms of college, the professors. Partly it's in the hands of administrators. And over the last 50 years, you've seen a lot more administrative control, supervision over what gets taught in the classroom. And partly it is a role of the community and parents and political parties, and certainly we're seeing this now over the last couple of years, a lot of discussions over mask mandates and, you know, Black Lives Matters in terms of what's being taught in classrooms. Here in Texas, where I'm from, we have laws passed about what educators can and cannot say or talk about in the classroom. And so, you know, in terms of the quality of the academic content, that's influenced by all of those various interests and parties, and it becomes very difficult on one level just for teachers to teach because they have to be thinking about, you know, pleasing everyone And, you know, the student often gets lost in that mess.
I have heard teachers from grammar school on up through college actually say that they thought when they entered the profession that they would have autonomy in the classroom because that's right. This is what they were.
And big surprise.
Yeah, this is what they were prepared for. And if they could have that freedom, they think they would have more dynamics within the classroom and that a student would walk away with something more fulfilling. In other words, open it up, have more of a discussion. But when you have mandates, whether it's from the federal government or state level or even your local community, they feel they have their hands tied. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great insight. And I was just talking to the wife of a family member who recently left teaching. Because she just couldn't, I mean, she was working really hard and diligently in the classroom to reach individual students, and having her daily struggles and daily successes, and, you know, over the school year, she felt very proud of what she was able to accomplish. And then there's the administrative side of, you know, these numbers and these, you know, policies, and she felt that her work was being disregarded, and in some case, ignored, that, you know, her numbers in 1 year came up excellent, but the school principal informed her that he couldn't actually award any teacher an excellent status just because of the way that the numbers are working out with the district. I think that one of the things I talk about in my books, that when it comes to teaching, it's such an intimate, personal process. It's a negotiation between teacher and students. It's a relationship, much like, you know, a brother and a sister, a husband or wife, friends. You know, two people are trying to come together to engage cooperatively in an activity, and that takes a lot of push and pull and personalized understandings. And, you know, when you have all these outside dictates, whether it be from administrators or from politicians, you know, teachers lose their ability to form a relationship with the student and have that personal relationship, that those daily interactions matter in terms of developing the learning of the student. You're worried more about, well, what do other people want me to do? What numbers am I supposed to be producing? And that interferes with your ability to meet that student's needs on any given day. And so certainly that is a big, big problem. And I think part of the solution, which not a lot of people really, you know, want to work towards or figure out how to renegotiate the structure of the school, but teachers need more control. I mean, we need to reduce the administrative oversight, the administrative control, and we need teachers to be in control of the process, including the process of evaluating other teachers. You know, who is the best position to evaluate teaching and learning? Teachers are the best, you know, to do that, not administrators, and certainly not politicians.
Right. Here's the thing that, and correct me if I'm wrong here, school districts rely on many, especially public school systems, rely heavily on tax dollars. As you talked about earlier, politicians write certain laws, certain rules about education.
Right.
And I've heard even from administrators say, well, you know what? If we don't keep these standards, we lose funding. So in other words, it's like a losing battle. If you don't meet certain criteria, then your funding is pulled and game over. Is that how education should be?
And I mean, and it's only gotten worse that since the 1990s, there's been a push on performance-based funding, mm-hmm. Where, you know, certain targets are kind of set in advance. You don't meet those targets, you lose funding. And then we're also seeing, you know, in Florida this year, for example, something that we've always seen for hundreds of years, and that's just the kind of the personal political priorities, where the governor of Florida is actually taking money away from school districts because they are having mask policies. And Texas as well is trying to move towards a similar type of law. So you have particular political parties or even particular governors, and they have their own pet policy. And they want to make sure everyone follows their policy to a T, and if you don't, we're going to take away your resources. So, yeah, there's definitely that external control over schooling, which is often tied to money and other resources. Most school districts funded by property taxes, and that's one of the root causes of political, social, racial inequality in this country, and the main reason why our schools today are more segregated, actually, than they were in the 1950s. Residential segregation. You know, no one is requiring people to live anywhere by law, but the best schools are located in the most expensive neighborhoods, and those expensive properties feed, you know, property taxes to make those schools great and filled with, you know, wonderful resources. Where poorer neighborhoods, lower property values, a lot less money flowing into the local schools. And many states have kind of top-up laws where supposedly they're allocating equal funds to the poorer schools, but that never actually works in practice. Definitely the money issue tied to resources. And one of the biggest resources is simply having trained teachers, teachers who are trained in the subject they're teaching in a classroom. You have that in rich, well-endowed school systems, private and public. In poorer schools, especially poorer public schools, you often don't have a lot of teachers who are fully trained in the subject they're teaching. You have a lot of temporary teachers, substitute teachers, math teachers teaching English or English teachers teaching math, and that is part of the, you know, root cause of a lot of the dysfunction and the poor learning of students is not having those resources.
Right. I want to just take a quick pause, then we'll be right back. I just want to let people know that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. My guest this week is author and educator Josh Beach, and we're talking about education. The way you go about evaluating education in this country, is it truly fair, and is it working? Josh, another thing that came to mind is, because you do mention it in one of your books, you know, we almost make it from the time that a child is born, whether it's through their own parents or peers, many times you've said it yourself, other students, especially with social media today, there's so much pressure put on these kids that if they don't get into an Ivy League school, if they don't get into the top schools, if they don't get the proper education, there'll be failures in life. I often come back and I get a lot of criticism and I say, well, that, you know, hey, I'm all for education. You have to be able to read and write. But there are many people who just didn't or don't do well in school, yet they go out into the world, you know, William Branson comes to mind, and do very, very well. Is there undue influence and pressure put on young people?
Yeah, and again, to circle back to that earlier comment about different groups and interests, I mean, there's so many different types of pressure that students have to deal with, social pressure. You know, what are my friends? What are they doing? What do they want me to do? What are my parents doing and what do they want me to do? You know, what are my church leaders, my political leaders? What are my teachers saying? There are so, you know, what are these social media influencers saying? There's so many different pressures put on students, and mental health issues for young adults and teens are just at unprecedented levels, that there's just so much that young adults, teens have to deal with nowadays that you and I really didn't have to think about when we were younger. But yeah, the pressure to go to college, certainly there's this widespread myth that's been propagated at least since the 1990s that everyone needs to go to college. Everyone must go to college, and anyone who doesn't go to college is a failure.
Right.
And that's a very costly myth. Number one, it's costly at an economic level because the facts are you don't necessarily need to go to college to earn a good living and make a high paying wage. There was a report that just came out confirming this again last week. There are many careers out there that require, you know, a couple years of schooling or just technical knowledge that you can go into right after high school or through a couple years of community college. Air conditioning, you know, construction, laboratory techs, many of these fields, you know, electrician, for example, two or three years to become an electrician. In California, you can make over $100,000 a year, more than I've ever made in a year as an educator, you know. So there are a lot of high-paying jobs, good jobs out there that pay a lot of money. You don't need a college education for. At the same time, a lot of college degrees are economically worthless. That students are paying, you know, $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 for a bachelor's degree or even a graduate degree, and there's no job attached. And then they are spending their life, you know, either working at a retail job or they happen to get some other job in some other field. But when it comes to the economic value of higher education, if you don't actually get a degree in the field you work at, you're not going to maximize your labor market returns. And so many students, they get a degree in one field, let's say political science, but then they end up getting some kind of administrative job at a corporation that doesn't require that degree, so they're not going to really get the maximum benefit of that political science degree because they didn't go into a field that, you know, values that degree very highly.
Yeah.
So yes, college is important, and in many ways you can see these numbers on average. College students, college graduates make a lot more money on average than high school graduates or people with some college, but it varies a lot by where you're working, where you're living, the kind of job or industry that you're in. It also varies a lot by race, class, and gender still. For various reasons, including, you know, outright discrimination, to just more, you know, intermediary effects like where you happen to live. You know, a lot of poor students, they go and earn their college degree, and then they go back to live close to their family, which happens to be in a economically depressed area. You know, even if they earned a medical degree and they're a doctor, if they're going to go back home and into an inner city environment that's very economically depressed, they're not going to be earning a lot of money as a doctor.
Right.
You know, if they wanted to maximize that value of that medical degree, they would need to live in some, you know, rich urban environment, a lot of rich white people, in order to maximize that degree. So, you know, there's a lot of specific factors that determine, you know, how much money and, you know, whether or not it's valuable to the individual, you know, for that college degree. And certainly there needs to be more done in high school to let students know you have a lot more options. It's not either or just you have to choose A, you have to go to college. And that
right.
puts a lot of pressure on students that are not academically gifted or even motivated to study. You know, a lot of students, they just, you know, they don't like school. They don't like to study. You know, there's still ways for these people to find valuable, you know, jobs in the labor market and to contribute to their communities. Schooling is not the only way. And so there needs to be more awareness of that fact.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because I know of a gentleman whose grandson, this gentleman happened to be in construction for many, many years, and the grandson had no intention of college. He hated school to begin with.
Uh-huh.
Did graduate from high school, went to work with his dad, who was an electrician, and his grandfather in the construction field, and 2 years ago sold to a major company his business because of the specialty of his work for close to $30 million. So, you know,
wow,
it's so just what you said. I mean, it's unfortunate that so many want to do other than the classroom kind of approach to life are almost put down. But let me go back to something else that stuck out in my mind also. I heard a young girl, a sophomore in high school a couple of years ago, saying that it's so difficult in the classroom. They have foreign students who've settled here, and they're just, she says, it's unbelievable. They're so smart. She says, I have to study 10 hours for what they can do in 20 minutes. Is there a difference? I mean, do other countries have a better way of educating young people? I mean, I always thought that this country was, exemplary in their education system. I'm not saying it's perfect, but this girl made it sound like, Jesus, I can't compete with people from other countries because they're so much smarter than I am. I thought, wow, you know, you just slapped yourself in the face. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's that perception, you know, where students don't always fully understand the mechanics of what's going on, either with the teacher or with other students. So a lot of students, they think in terms of smart or not smart. I have abilities or I don't have abilities. You know, whether it's in terms of how well they do in assignments or, you know, comparing themselves to other peers. That's the wrong way to think about learning and education. Now, as far as, you know, thinking about high-performing peers, whether or not they're born in this country or not, what it often boils down to is the type of reinforcement that that academic schooling and learning, that kind of reinforcement that's there outside of the classroom. So when you go to other countries, so I've lived and worked in China and South Korea, and I can tell you that in those countries there is intense social pressure from everyone, the entire family, the entire extended community, on every student to do extremely well in school. And the performance of the student in school, starting in grade school, is a reflection of the social status of the entire family. And so there's intense pressure on students. And so in Korea, for example, where I spent a lot of time teaching, students from the age of 3 or 4 years old, not only do they go to school all week long, but after school they spend hours, sometimes 4 to 6 hours every day of the school week. And the majority of their entire week on Saturday and Sunday, from morning until late at night, they are getting tutoring, extracurricular learning activities. And so there is this intense pressure. There's a loose translation of a Korean phrase, education fever, that everyone has this kind of feverish need to be academically successful. And so when those students come to America, for example, they bring that set of cultural values with them. And so their parents are pushing their students to do really well in school. And when they get home from school, their parents are there, you know, helping them with their schoolwork or hiring tutors and putting that pressure. You got to spend X amount of hours doing your homework, not necessarily, you know, going out to play with your friends or socializing. And so I think a lot of American students, we don't have that kind of social pressure. A lot of families don't put, I mean, you know, you come home, okay, take a break, watch some TV, go hang out with your friends, you know, maybe go play some sports. But with other groups of students, it's no, you come home, you go straight back to your schoolwork, you spend hours doing your homework, you know, you work with your tutor, because we want you to get into the best school, we want you to get the best grades. It's just this cultural reinforcement. Yeah. And so I think that's the ingredient that a lot of people don't understand. It's not internal to the student themselves, it's just a group of people that really see schooling as the only way for them to advance socially and economically, and right. Especially for immigrants, you know. Right. They often feel that they're at a disadvantage, that, you know, how are we going to succeed in this new environment? They think schools, that's the primary way. So we've got to pour all of our resources and energy to get our children to be successful in school so they can be successful in this new environment.
Right. Josh, I don't remember... I started off in parochial school. It's just, you know, just the way my parents were, you know, religious, Catholic, and they thought this was the way to go. I mean, they by the time it was all said and done, I think they regretted sending me there. But that's beside the point. But what I'm getting at is that, is it necessary to even measure? I mean, back then it was like, oh well, you go to St. Joe's or you go to St. Stephen's or St. Mary's,
right?
People automatically thought you're a step above us. I've had friends that went to the public school system and I've heard their parents say that. But going back to what you talked about earlier, in fact, you mentioned it quite a bit in your book, measuring. How is it even possible to truly measure an economic system, whether it's nationally, on a state level, or even local level? And should we be doing that?
Excellent. That's excellent. Yeah, and you're spot on in separating those two questions. Can we and should we? And it's something that I think every parent needs to think about in terms of where they put their child. We have our young son who is 4 years old right now, preschool, and we have him in a Catholic school. My wife is Catholic. Partly because here in Texas, even at the preschool level, there is just a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of testing, you know, and we wanted him to be in an environment where there's going to be some structure, but also a lot of playing and, you know, social environment, that we didn't want to have too much academic pressure placed on him too early. And so can we measure, should we measure? Two very different questions. The first, boils down to a technical scientific question. Can we measure what actually goes on in the classroom, what goes on in the student's brain? The simple answer is no, we can't. And I don't know if we're ever going to be able to. Maybe with advances in neuroscience, we're going to have a better understanding of how the brain works and how learning works. But there's so much about teaching and student learning inside of classrooms that's simply invisible, that can't be seen by an outsider. And that even when, you know, I've done a lot of teacher evaluations where I've sat in classrooms of my colleagues watching them teach, I don't fully see and understand the nuances of everything that's going on in that classroom. You know, you have a person at the front of the room and you have, you know, 10 to 20 or 30 students in the back of the room. I can't see everything. And I certainly can't see inside of the head of each student. Are they engaged? Are they motivated? Do they want to be there? Are they? What are they learning? What are they struggling with? So, no, you can't really measure all that. And then the separate question is, should we? You know, how important is it to try to come up with numbers? And what are we doing with those numbers? What's the point? So if the point is to use numbers to make the educational practices better, then I'm all for it. That's great. And I'm definitely a proponent of evidence-based management and evidence-based practices where we use science, we use evaluation in order to understand what we're doing and to do it better. Doctors do this, engineers do this, educators can also do this. But if we're using these numbers for political reasons, right, in terms of sorting and ranking people, to say these people are better because they have a higher number, these people are worse because they have a lower number, and we're going to punish those people with the lower numbers, and we're going to, you know, give undue advantages and celebrations to the people with higher numbers, no, that's a very destructive process, whether it's in schools or in businesses. Yeah. And there's been a lot of research, evidence-based research, in terms of the business community, where businesses use that type of process to rank and sort employees in order to punish the lower performer ones and, you know, lavish high pay on the high performers. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It's never worked. And so, you know, taking that failed policy from the business environment and try to force it on schools, it's just poison, and it's just destroying the whole system.
As we start to wind down here this evening, I'm just so glad that you framed it that way, because I remember growing up it was 30 or 40 guys, and we used to hang around a local park, and nobody thought that, you know, I was somewhat fortunate there was a family business to go into that I chose not to down the road, but one of those kids became the chief of police. His brother became an investigator. One is a doctor. Three are lawyers. One is a real estate mogul up here in Central Mass.
I mean,
but I look back now, and people would, you know, just what you said. People say, "Oh my God, that roughneck group never amount to anything." And I heard that as a kid. I've heard that from neighbors. You would hear that from family members. And it's just not fair, and it's just not right. So I'm so glad to hear that, you know, you're not a proponent.
That's a great insight.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you never know.
Right.
You never know.
Exactly.
You know, that, and as a student or as a teacher, there's just so much untapped possibility inside every human being.
Yep.
That in order to make a premature judgment at any age, it's just self-defeating, and it's just arrogant, you know? You never know what a human being is going to be able to do with their life.
And as you said earlier, you know, dangling the proverbial, you know, carrot out there that, you know, if that's a better school district based on these measurements, these metrics, then let's funnel more of the money there and build better schools and give them the, you know, the new latest and greatest of technology.
Right.
Totally unfair. Totally unfair.
Right.
And
rich schools get more rewards.
Oh, yeah.
And the poor schools get punished, and they get rewards.
Right.
They
right.
get resources taken away. It's just a self-defeating process.
Exactly.
It doesn't make any sense.
Exactly. Josh, if people want to get more information, do you have a website or a way they can reach out to you?
Yeah. JMBeach.com. Simple as that. JMBeach.com.
And the new book, in fact, two new books that Josh has just recently authored. have been out, the myths and measurements of meritocracy. I got it right this time. And how can we measure what matters most? And the title alone is, you know, is very telling. Do we go about measuring our education systems in this country properly? Josh makes some great arguments as to what might be the better approach and what is working and what does not work. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.